Ecclesiastes chapter 1 this evening. I, the preacher, verse 12, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. But I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is but striving after the wind. And much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And Father, now as we study your word, we pray that you would teach us the important lessons that are here. This is not just the musings of a very frustrated man. This is not just about coming to a conclusion that is very discouraging. And these are not the words of somebody who's distraught and hopeless. But they are true words. And this is what life looks like when we forget that you're a great and pardoning, wonderful God. So give us a very good dose of reality here this evening, Lord. Help us to remember life and help us to remember you, in whom we find real life, abundant life. We thank you for what you will do for us, in us, through Jesus Christ. In whose name we thank you and praise you. Amen. Well, on March 8th, 2015, the ISIS in the Levant started the destruction, plunder of Deir Shuruk, or Deir Shurukin sometimes it is called. That's the modern-day city of course, about Iraq. We read about this. We heard about it on the news. Probably you remember. I remember it specifically when this started happening. And I rather suspect when the average American heard about this plundering of this ancient city, the response was something like, you know, so what? Let's go to the ball game and do something important. But this archaeological site was one of the premier archaeological sites containing so much valuable information from ancient ages. Antiquities had just shed so much light on what was going on in the Middle Ages. And so, therefore, this site was very significant to Jews and to Christians alike. Because what would happen very often is the archaeologists in sites like this, and this site in particular, would uncover evidence that affirmed, that bore out the truths that we found in the Old Testament. And so much there was so significant. It just simply verified that which we consider to be very important in the Word of God. One of the more significant finds in that archaeological site was this loaf of bread. It's not a loaf of bread. It looks like a loaf of bread or a misshapen peanut. Or if you look at closely, what you discover there is all kinds of writing. Okay, this thing is covered with writing all the way around. And you wouldn't be able to read it. It's not in English. But this is called the Deir Shurukin Foundation Cylinder, okay? It's a story. It's the whole story about the founding of this city, Deir Shurukin. The city was founded by Sargon II. And this story on this cylinder is kind of like an autobiography of Sargon II. And it tells how the city was started in the year 717 B.C. Now, you being Bible scholars the way you are going to say, oh, that's really significant. Because that's only 5 years after Sargon II, beginning his reign, wipes out the nation of Israel, scattered the people of Israel, having taken the city of Samaria. Tells the story how the city was 10 years in the building, which would have taken you to about the year 207. But in that time, Sargon II was in and out of the town a lot, and he left the building of that city a lot a lot of that responsibility was given to his son, who was the crown prince who would take over after him, and his name happened to be Sennacherib. And I know most of you didn't name your children that, but that name's very significant, isn't it? Because Sennacherib is found in your Old Testament, especially in 1 Kings 18:19. And so we're reading this story about this man who was a contemporary of people like Hezekiah. Sennacherib had a run-in with Hezekiah, you'll remember. Now, the really sad part about this story is about the time the city was finished, 1 year after it was done in the year 705, maybe 706 at the latest, Sargon II was killed in battle. And I could go into the story about Josiah and Egypt coming, but you don't want to hear all that here this evening. But as you read on this cylinder, all of this historical accounts, this autobiography kind of Sargon II, you get this idea that his life was kind of like Solomon's. You know, it was a record of experiments and forays into construction and into development of various things and searching out wisdom and how he tried to find satisfaction in life. You know, that's what we're reading about Solomon in Ecclesiastes. Now, the bad news is Sargon II died without ever finding satisfaction, even after all his experiments and all of his searching. The good news is Solomon did a very similar kind of thing, but in the end, he returned to God, and he returned to the truth of his God, and he found great satisfaction in God. And so we're reading, kind of in Ecclesiastes, Solomon's autobiography, which stands in vivid contrast to the autobiography of not only Sargon II, but a lot of the kings who were contemporaries of Solomon and even beyond and after him, who never found satisfaction. But Solomon did. Our text that we've chosen here this evening, chapter 1, verse 12 through verse 18, really is kind of just the beginning. You have a large section here that runs all the way through from chapter 1, verse 12, all the way through chapter 2 to the end of the chapter. It's really Solomon's record of this futile search and using human wisdom in order to search out the truth to try to find the meaning of life. And so we have this record that we'll look at over the next couple of weeks, plumbing the depths of human wisdom, be able to find out the meaning, the purpose, why we're here, what life is all about. But if we never resort to God, we never get the answer. We never find satisfaction. And we come to the conclusion that the more we learn, the more we find out, the more we discover, the greater grief we have. That's chapter 1, verse 18. I think I've told you before, almost kidding, but not altogether. Years ago, my wife and I kind of chose this as our life's verse. With greater knowledge comes greater sorrow. Boy, you know, there is a truth to that. Let's see how Solomon came to that conclusion. You have the preacher's vexation. That'd be a good title for a sermon also, for preachers. The preacher's research, you know, revealed that human wisdom really doesn't have the answers. You can exercise human wisdom all that you want, and you end up with the same kind of testimony that you have from this preacher king, whose name is what? Well, let's see, verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now, from this identifying statement, we get a real good idea of who the writer of this book actually is. He was, at some point, king over Israel. Well, that could be said of several kings. There were a dozen kings who were kings over Israel. So was it any one of those dozen of kings? Well, no. You know, some scholars would come to the conclusion, well, yeah, it might have been Hezekiah, because Hezekiah was very wise and Hezekiah was rather rich, and Hezekiah did expand the boundaries of the city of Jerusalem, but Hezekiah never ruled over Israel. He only ruled over Jerusalem. So whoever this king is has to be a king who ruled in Jerusalem over the nation of Israel. Now, how many kings would qualify for simply that? Well, there were three kings who ruled over the entire United Kingdom of Israel. Who were they? Saul, David, Solomon. And of those three kings, how many of them ruled from Jerusalem? Well, not Saul. He was king in Gibeah. David made Jerusalem the capital of the United Kingdom of Israel. That's Judah and Israel together. And so only David and Solomon ruled over the United Kingdom, Israel, from Jerusalem. So, I know David didn't write this. So that leaves me with Solomon, and I'm pretty content with that. You don't have to be if you don't want to be, but I think the preacher must be Solomon. And I think that's an important conclusion for us to draw in light of the characteristics that we see given to us regarding this preacher, this king, this man of words and sentences. We described that a couple of weeks ago. We know that he was notoriously wise. We know from this writing, Ecclesiastes, he was notoriously creative. We know that he was notoriously rich. We know that he was notoriously licentious. We're going to see that in a couple of weeks when he talks about really trying to learn all that life has to give through pleasure. And all of those characteristics figure significantly in the lifestyle, in the experiments, the searching, the frustration of this preacher. So what did he learn? Having applied himself through human wisdom to all these aspects of life, what did this preacher learn through his research and curiosity? Well, he learned that we have a very unhappy business. Now, here's a man who was certainly not lazy. He was certainly not careless. He wasn't inaccurate in his research. And so we know from what we're reading here in this book that he applied himself diligently. And he applied himself to a noble goal, verse 13. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under the heaven. Now, if you just look at those simple words, to seek and to search out, those words are going to require a certain amount of diligence. Yea, a lot of diligence. This is somebody who has to be really serious about what he's doing because he's inquiring. He's doing careful research. This is something that maybe a detective would do, or maybe someone would do as they're getting ready to write their dissertation, and they just pour themselves into the research in order to find the answers. That's what Solomon was doing. In fact, the word is used 11 different times in the Old Testament. Most of the time, this word is used in the account in Numbers. It talks about the spies going into the Promised Land to find out, to research, to look out, to investigate what the Promised Land was really like. And Solomon says, why use those same kinds of ideas when I was searching out with wisdom to find the answers to life? I applied myself is the word that he used. And we would use that word. You know, we might use it in such a way as say, I applied myself to such an extent to this project, whatever it was, that I was totally consumed with it. Have you ever known anybody like that? I mean, they take on a project and they get so consumed that it's like, hello, you know, there's some other people around here. Why are you all smiling at me? Yes, I'm like that. You know, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to pour myself into it completely. And I do. I just get distracted. And I don't know what else is going on around me. I mean, I knew a man one time who was really into video games. And he was older in life, and his kids bought him some video games. And, I mean, he just got so consumed with this, just totally applied himself to this. And his basement leaked when it rained. And his wife went down to the basement one day and found him in the basement playing video games on the television in ankle-deep water and didn't know it. Okay, that's the word that would be used here, okay? Solomon, man, I mean, he just poured himself into it. You know, nothing else really attracted him whatsoever. Okay, he's serious. He wants to find out some answers. And he's not simply thinking about. You know, it's not just something that is a passing thought in his mind. He's pouring his whole person, his whole heart, and trying to find an answer to this dilemma, what is life all about? So he uses all of the human wisdom he can possibly gather. And by the way, probably Solomon had access to an awful lot of human wisdom. And so he draws himself into these conclusions. And I think, from what, as we read through this book, I get the idea that this was not something he did in a few days or a couple weeks. I think this was probably a years-long project near the end of Solomon's life, as he's trying to learn what life is all about. And yet, through all of this diligent research and all of this careful observation, what does he learn? He comes to the conclusion, God has given us an unhappy business. Well, that's not very encouraging. Now, how would you feel if your neighbor walks up to you tomorrow and says, "You're a believer, right?" "Yeah." "How's your unhappy business going?" "Oh, you mean life?" But that's Solomon's conclusion. Verse 13. Last part of the verse. "It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with." And that's the conclusion you come to when you're trying to explain life's questions, life's enigmas, life's confusion. It's a heavy burden. And it does lead to unhappiness. It's like, life is like trying to herd cats. Maybe you've heard that before. You know, that's the most frustrating thing I can imagine. How do you make cats obey? And you know, the unhappy business was not God's design. That's the whole enigma. God has given us an unhappy business because life was really, really happy until Adam and Eve brought sin into the world and broke God's perfect creation. Everything would have been fine if it wasn't for sin, but because of sin, now we have this enigma. We have this puzzle of life that began in Genesis chapter 3. And now, because of this sin, even beginning in Genesis chapter 3, the wife goes through life, all through her life, wishing she had the position of her husband, frustrated because she does not, knowing full well that she is smarter than he is, better than he is. We'll go stop right there, but that's her lot. And it's an unhappy business. And man goes about his work over and over and over, pulling out the same weeds from the same spot in the same garden. And every few weeks he goes back and that same weed is there. And he knows he pulled it out. He put Roundup on it, but there it is. And that is the story of his life. And he just keeps going over and over to the same thing until he finally dies. And Solomon says, what is the meaning of this? Well, it's a very unhappy business because the job is never done. It's always there. Nearly every day, it seems like, I know it doesn't happen every day, but it seems like every day I sit down at the dinner table and my mom will have the same question for me. "Dave, did you get all your work done today?" And I always have the same answer. "Mom, work will never be done in this life." And that is life. Solomon says that's an unhappy business. And life's puzzle is an unhappy business. Because we often don't know the answers. We just don't know. You know, regardless of what the question is, regardless of what the dilemma we're trying to deal with, we really don't know what the answer is. And what's even more frustrating is possibly we never will in this life. It's hard to walk away from the questions. So can you be satisfied to trust God with unanswered questions, with confusing issues, with circumstances that don't make sense to you, that seem to be very unfair, with those scenarios of life that seem unjust and you can't find justice or answers or conclusions? Can you trust God to know what is best and to be in control of those bewildering matters? Or do you say, well, we've got to have an answer. We cannot let this thing go until we solve this dilemma. And, you know, if you do that, you'll end up being stubborn against God. Being stubborn against God is just trying to control circumstances. And you end up trying to invent solutions that are contrary to God's will. And that only makes your burden heavier and your business more unhappy. And Solomon's speaking of God here. God has given us an unhappy business. Yeah, this is one of the few times that God even shows up in this book. And I read this and I say, hey, Solomon, that just makes me think for a minute. Where was God in this whole research? Was God at the center of all of your thinking, of all of your investigation? You know, I would think so, especially in light of Solomon's connection between wisdom and God. I mean, he does this regularly throughout, especially Proverbs. When he wrote to his son and he gave wise information, wise advice to his son, Rehoboam, this is one of the things that he told him. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom instruction. Well, where was God in the center of all of your research, Solomon? He also said the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Okay, did you have God at the center of all of your experiments in life? In fact, we're going to read in Ecclesiastes in this account, this biography of this big experiment of his. Ecclesiastes 3, verse 14, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 7, for when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 18, it is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Well, the good news is that finally, by the time he got to the end of this experiment and the end of all this research in life, Solomon landed right there with God. And you know the conclusion. 12, 13, the end of the matter, all's been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, this is the whole duty of man. But yet, really, throughout Ecclesiastes, I just gave you almost all the references to God. Half a dozen at the most. It's almost like what we're reading, that Solomon said, I used human wisdom, I searched the depths of human wisdom, I plumbed all the depths with all the wisdom that I could gather together. And what I came up with was very frustrating. God has given us an unhappy business. Solomon, why didn't you just trust God, depend on God, forget about the rest? I think I know the answer to that. In our text of about seven verses, I want you to notice in five verses his overuse of personal pronouns. Verse 12, I. Verse 13, I. My. Verse 14, I. Verse 16, I, me, my. Verse 17, I again. You get the idea? Maybe he was relying too heavily on himself. Golden Gate wrote this, he said, the occupational hazard of the wise man is to walk by calculation rather than by faith. And when we are walking by calculation, what we can figure out, rather than by faith, we're going to end up discovering that life is a lot like trying to catch wind. That's frustrating. Solomon came to the conclusion, really, all of life is like that. All the activity on earth is just futile. Verse 14, I've seen everything that is done under the sun. Behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. And I say, come on, Solomon, you didn't see everything. I mean, you're not omniscient. You're not omnipresent like God. God is omniscient, omnipresent. He sees everything. Solomon, this is hyperbole. You did not see everything. But Solomon would say to me, well, listen, Wickham, what I'm really saying here is I've seen every kind of thing. I've seen all kind of commerce. I've seen all kinds of construction. I've seen all kinds of merchandising. I've seen all kinds of science. I've seen all kinds of education. I've seen all kinds of philosophy. Every kind of thing. Okay, that's fair enough. And having investigated all these kinds and ways of human thinking and activity, He came to the conclusion that all the activity of earth is vain, it's futile, and we would too. Picture a child. It's fall. Maybe you just raked the leaves in your yard, and along comes one of those little whirlwinds. Sometimes we call them dust devils. And your child's out in the yard, and here comes the wind, and picks up those leaves, and he, being curious, is going to go over there, and he's going to grab a handful of wind, right? And when he opens his hand, what's there? Nothing. And Solomon says, that's life. Grab all you want. In the end, you don't have anything. And that is all vanity, because life is like striving after wind. Some of you might say, well, my Bible doesn't say that. My Bible says all in life is vanity and vexation of spirit. And that's true. That's true. But the word that is translated in some English versions, vexation, really does mean striving. It's reuth. It means to chase after, reach out for, and strive to get a hold of this thing. It's to have an aim. It's to have a purpose. It's to long for something and try to achieve it. Well, that would be a description of vanity if you didn't get anything in the process. This word at the end of your verse there, in verse 14, it wind, ruach. It's a very common word in the Hebrew. It talks about our breath. And it talks about wind. It can talk about a spirit. You know, spirit's like wind and breath. You can't see it. And so it's a very, very good picture that Solomon gives us. This is what vanity looks like. This is emptiness. Remember that word, Hebel? This is what it looks like. You are striving for, you're running after, you're intent on grabbing spirit, wind, breath. And just when you think you have a handful of it, you have to come to the reality. There's nothing here. Now, go ahead and fill in those pictures with what's important to you. Your education, your possessions, your position in life, you know, whatever it might be, your relationships. And that's what you chase after, and that's what you run after, and you're reaching out, you're trying to grab it, and you finally get a handful of it, and you ultimately open your hands, and there's nothing there of any value. And that's vanity, emptiness, futility. And we expend all the effort, and all the time, and all the energy that is allotted to us in life. And by the way, you only have so much of it. That's why we're supposed to manage it. Life is not a video game. Okay, life's not like a video game where you fall off the earth or whatever it is. I was playing one with my grandson a few days ago, and I kept falling off this cube. I'm not even sure what it was. No problem, Granddad. Hit the reset button. Life's not like that. Okay, we're only given so much time, so much energy, so many opportunities, and we have to manage those things. And we spend all of that trying to achieve, chasing after, reaching out to grasp what people say we ought to grasp, what we ought to achieve in life. And so we do it. And in the end, what do we have? Pile of useless trinkets. After chasing after everything that everybody said we ought to have, you know what we have is a room full of VCRs, 8-track tape players, floppy disks, cordless landline phones. And some of you younger people don't even know what I'm talking about. That's useless junk. You can't even give away your floppy disk. Who wants it? And after living 80 years like this and just burning ourselves out on the treadmill of life, the vast majority of Americans have no better understanding of the meaning and purpose of life than they did when they were 4 years old. It's useless. We're running helter-skelter after all the passing things of life and find out that it never led us closer at all to the Creator, who alone gives us the meaning of life and who alone is able to give us abundant life. And somehow we think if we work harder, chase harder, look harder, research harder, we can change everything and we can make it all different. And Solomon said, no, I've tried that. Things just don't change very much. Verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. You know, even secular scholars tell us things like, the more things change, the more they remain the same. You ever heard anything like that? And there's a truth to that. Solomon put it like this in Ecclesiastes 1:9. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. And so in God's plan, what is crooked cannot be made straight. We try to straighten out the crooked, only to discover that even after all of our labors and all of our time and all the effort we poured into it, we haven't made the crooked straight. It's still just as crooked as it ever was, if nothing else. It's worse. Kind of like what I say about the government. If it ain't broke, fix it till it is. The crooked can't be made straight. Or worse, we try to redefine crooked. Watch the socialists in your culture. They're notorious for this. They will redefine crooked because they can't fix crooked. So many presidents over the years, you know, especially in the last, 75 years, they've all had a plan. We're going to eliminate poverty. How do they eliminate poverty? Well, they always pass bills and come up with plans where they tax the working people more and more and more, and they make the employers pay more and more and more, higher minimum wage, and yet over 75 years, they haven't gotten rid of poverty. In fact, if anything, they've made it worse. We have way more people living under bridges today than we did in the 1960s and 70s. What's the problem? You try to make the crooked straight and it doesn't work. Even when we try to change people, individuals, we come to the conclusion, oh, you know what? Only God can do that. Jeremiah chapter 13, verse 23, God says, well, can a leper change his spots? No, only I do that. Therefore, we come to the conclusion, sometimes it's very startling to us, that sometimes God makes things crooked, and He intends for them to be crooked, and we're wasting our time trying to make them straight. You say, that's probably just about the dumbest thing I ever heard, Pastor. Well, look at Ecclesiastes 7, verse 13. What does this mean? Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? Have you ever tried to straighten out what God makes crooked? You say, oh, I don't know that God's ever made anything crooked. Well, look at your own life. I bet you have some crooks in your life. Not by that, I don't mean thieves. I mean, you have some crooks and turns, and you probably have been frustrated about that. And you probably have thought, you know, why do I have these things in my life? Why has God allowed these kinds of circumstances in my life? Well, I would encourage you to read a book that wasn't written yesterday. The title of it is The Crook in the Lot. It was written by Thomas Boston. I mean, he lived way back in the latter part of the 17th century, early part of the 18th century. And it's a deep read. It's a heavy read. I'm just going to tell you. But it's a very rewarding read. As you read through this book, and as the whole title kind of reveals, the rest of the title is The Sovereignty and Wisdom of God that He Displays in the Afflictions of Men. And what Boston did here is he presented, quote, a just view of afflicting incidents as being altogether necessary to a Christian deportment under them. And that view is to be obtained only by faith, not by sense. For it is the light of the Word alone that represents them justly, discovering in them the work of God, and consequently designs becoming the divine perfections. And when they are perceived by the eye of faith and duly considered, we have a just view of afflicting incidents, fitted to quell the turbulent motions of corrupt affections under dismal outward appearances. I told you it was heavy. But boy, you just read this and start digest it and you realize God has a good reason for putting crooks in our life. God has a good reason for not making your path nice and straight as an arrow lined by roses along the way. These twists and turns are on purpose. And Solomon says when you research, when you find out the answers and you start learning, you just realize God makes some things crooked. And when you try to straighten them out, it can become very, very frustrating. All right, let's close. Kind of. Even the greatest human wisdom leads to futility. Verse 16, 17, 18. Here's this preacher who has surpassing wisdom. He has superior wisdom over anything that humans had. He said in verse 16, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. I mean, to whom would this phrase apply more accurately than somebody like Solomon? God miraculously gave this guy superior wisdom, unusual wisdom. You'll remember the story. When Solomon was finally made king, David appointed him as king. God went to Solomon, met with him, and said, hey, Solomon, ask whatever you want. It's all yours. 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5. Talk about a genie from a bottle. I grant you three wishes. God said, whatever you want, Solomon, ask. What did he ask for? 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 6 through verse 9. He says, I need understanding to lead your people because they are a great people. They are your people, and I'm just a child. He wasn't. He was an adult, but compared to his father, he was just a child. And he said, Lord, all I need is great understanding. That's all I need. What did God give him? 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 11. And God said to him, because you have asked this and have not asked for yourselves long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind so that none like you has been before you and none like you shall arise after you. Well, that's a lot of wisdom. I give you also what you've not asked, both riches and honor so that no other king shall compare with you all of your days. So we're not surprised. As continue reading the history, the biography of Solomon, realize his wisdom was famous. God made him exactly what he said that he would. 1 Kings 3, verse 28, all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of God was with him to do justice. And so his wisdom was surpassing. You know, from 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 29, God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand of the sea and the seashore, so that all Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people in the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was far wiser than a list of these other great wise men. And so he composes the Proverbs and the 1,005 songs, and he spoke of this, that, and that. His wisdom was incredible. And everybody knew it. And so when he says, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, he's not bragging. That's not an arrogant boast. He's just telling the facts. I had that kind of wisdom. And not only did he have that kind of wisdom, notice he had superior experience. Last part of verse 16, in my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I mean, he just goes after it, applying himself, using all the wisdom he can find and all the experiences that he can possibly gender. And he looks and he searches and he has more opportunities and more abilities than all of his peers. And he comes to this conclusion. Apart from God, I don't have any explanation for why life is the way it is. That's a good conclusion. And yet he comes to the conclusion also that his wisdom led to greater futility. Why? Well, notice he tried figuring out wisdom, at the same time tried to figure out foolishness. Verse 17, I applied my heart to know wisdom, to know madness, to know folly. I perceived that this also is striving after the wind. And so he's using human wisdom, which would be equivalent to our philosophy, maybe human philosophy, and he's using the best that he can possibly use. And we stop to think about all of our philosophers and all the philosophers of ancient history. And you know, there were some guys like Aristotle and Plato who came very, very close to finding the truth. They just didn't quite get to God. But they were very accurate in a lot of their conclusions, and a lot of the philosophies of these ancient philosophers was pretty accurate. And some of it was just plain dumb. And Solomon says, I was looking at both ends. I was looking at the wisdom and I was looking at folly over here. And wisdom over here is what leads to God. And folly is like Socrates. It's all about the flesh. Or more modern day philosophers. People like Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, who, by the way, at this moment are probably shocked at the truth, since they both passed away. Solomon says, you know, it's all folly. It's madness. It's all ridiculous. It's all, maybe if Solomon could be really, really frank with us, he said, you know, folly and human foolishness is as dumb as having 700 wives and 300 concubines. He had to come to that conclusion. He said, you know, really? Ignorance is bliss. Verse 18. And much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, in much wisdom is much vexation. This is a different Hebrew word than the word that's translated vexation in verse 14 in the King James, for example. This word means anger, provocations, grief, frustration. In much wisdom, frustration, anger. Remove from the story of life all of the hope and all of the help that comes only from our Creator. And this is what you're left with. Anger, frustration, discouragement, disappointment. You know, it's even possible to look at your world through the wisdom of God and come to the same kind of vexation of your spirit. Folks, it's really easy for us to take the wisdom of God's word, look through that word at our world and say, this makes me angry. I just mentioned in my Sunday school class this morning how America is the worst offender. There is more human trafficking going on in America than any place else in the world. That makes me angry. Abortion makes me angry. Sexual perversion makes me angry. The lies that we just hear perpetrated all the time just makes me frustrated. It makes me discouraged. What is the solution to that? Well, Solomon said the easy solution would be turn off your radio. Turn off your computer. Close your eyes. Don't talk to anybody. Go hide in a cave. Ignorance is bliss. And there are people like that who would say, with greater wisdom comes greater vexation. I get more discouraged the more I know. It would really be easy for us to come to that conclusion when we forget to trust the blessed controller of all things. Folks, God's still in charge. God's still in control, and God knows exactly what's going on. In fact, He knows more about what is going on than we do. And He has greater wisdom than we do, and He is not vexed. He is not discouraged, distraught. But it is easy for us to say, he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Would we prefer to go back to a time of ignorance? Lots of times when we say the good old days, that's what we're talking about. Man, you know, the good old days of when I was 9 years old. Way less knowledge than I have now. Way less vexation. You know, when we're children, the impact that sin makes in life, we really just don't understand it at all, unless we're living in an abusive situation. And way too many kids are living in an abusive situation. I realize that. But a kid who's living in an idyllic situation, a Christian home as it ought to be, They just have no idea the impact of sin. They have no idea how it wrecks lives, how it destroys futures. And they grow up in those years, and then they become teens, and in the teen years they start to get a taste, and they start begin to see some of the consequences of the sin principle that's in our world. And they begin to run into other people, and they begin to run, have relationships, and relationships don't always work, and they become a little bit discouraged, and then they move into later adulthood, and finally we find ourselves in the waning years of adulthood, and it's really easy after all of our experiences with people who are living in a sin-impacted world, and therefore they're sinners themselves, for us to become cynical and critical because we're so discouraged. Always wishing we didn't even know. Somehow I wish I could go back. But we have to go to chapter 12 and say, now wait a minute. Remember your Creator. All through life, remember your Creator. Now folks, it is true. Your world is vain, your world is futile, and therefore we are discouraged, and therefore we get frustrated, and therefore we do have vexation because we have run after the wind, we have grabbed a handful, and there's nothing there. And the only antidote to that is talk to your Father in heaven. You just regularly need to go to God. Talk to Him. He invites you to do that. That's why He invites you to do that. And when you're talking to Him, remind Him of the truths that He said in His Word, because you're reading His Word and you realize these are wonderful promises and they still apply because God is really still in control regardless of the vanity and the vexation of your life. God's still there giving you hope through life for the abundant life, giving you hope for eternal life. And I think it's okay for us even to pray to this God who loves us so much. Even so, come quickly, Lord Jesus. Yeah, I know that sounds like an escape. It is. It's a wonderful, divinely appointed escape from a world that is absolutely crushed by sin. But while we live here and while we function in this world, we still have the abundant life only through our hope in the Lord Jesus Christ. Isn't that a great hope? And when greater knowledge makes you feel worse, just go talk to God about it.